Welcome back to Stacktrace, the podcast where we talk about Apple news and rumors from a developer's perspective. I'm John Sundell.
And I'm Guy Rambo.
All right, we're back here after two long weeks with lots of things happening. You know, we've had the Microsoft Build Conference, we had Google I.O., lots of crazy things happening, lots of rumors leading up to WWDC. So amongst this perfect storm of things happening, how are you, Guy?
I'm very good, thank you. I'm working very hard on my WWDC for Mac app because we need to get it done for WWDC and we have some brand new features we want to ship. And yeah, so been coding like crazy.
Yeah, I can imagine. Do you always need to update this WWDC app every year? Like, or is it just that you want to kind of extend the scope of it and add new things to it?
We do have to do basic maintenance every year because they changed the API endpoints for each WWDC edition. Last year, they changed the entire structure of the data a few days before WWDC. And as you can imagine, it was very crazy having to rewrite tons of JSON parsing code in a hurry.
Oh, yeah.
But last year, we had a major rewrite of the app, which was version 5. And this year we are releasing version 6, which is just lots and lots of improvements and some new features.
Awesome. So we should start with some follow-up. Last episode, we talked a little bit about Mac development and how it can either be like more accessible or less accessible, depending on kind of how you look at it and if you're coming from an iOS background. And we had an article posted by Shaps, who talks a little bit about his experience trying to transition to Mac development from iOS development. And he calls it iOS to macOS, a developer's journey. So you want to summarize this a little bit, Rambo?
Yeah, sure. So he mentioned several aspects of what's different about the Mac and why is it so hard for iOS developers to move to the Mac. And he mentioned the first item is product definition. So how different the product has to be on different platforms. And I think he has a very good point there because mobile devices are, well, mobile and you usually don't carry your Mac around on the road. So that's a very good point. And you have to think about that when designing and thinking about the user experience. Also, what people expect from your app. So people expect macOS apps to handle multiple windows and iOS is just a single window. And that's a big difference. And on the Mac, you have the menu bar and the dock and all of that.
And drag and drop and things like that.
All of that stuff. There are some things I don't agree with him. One thing that grabbed my attention was how he described the menu API. So I'm quoting, he said, a fairly obscure API for dealing with menus, for example, uses a legacy target action approach paired with a few informal delegate methods that allow you to enable, disable, rename, etc. So I have an issue with you calling target action a legacy approach because that's like, I know it's been in existence for a long time, but that doesn't make it legacy necessarily. It's just different. And it's not that much different from iOS because iOS still uses target action for buttons and stuff. You don't have a block-based button API yet, do we?
Yeah, no, that's right. Target action is fairly common on iOS as well. And yeah, I agree. This is sometimes something that I see quite a lot in the community, like people referring to like the delegate-based APIs as legacy and, you know, wanting to rewrite all the delegate-based code using closures and blocks instead. And you can certainly have your preference, like I prefer blocks or I prefer delegates, I prefer target action or notifications or observers. There are so many different patterns you can use. I personally think that all of these kind of different patterns, they have different pros and cons. And I think as developers, we shouldn't necessarily just like treat one as like legacy or old or, you know, we should remove all of it, but rather look at it and see like, what's the reason for this API to be designed this way? And for example, if we take the target action approach, It's pretty sweet because it enables us to get like a specific method call whenever something happens in the UI, and we don't need to like keep track of all the states in a closure, for example, which, you know, has other challenges, like you could easily cause a retain cycle, or you might need to capture some variables and you end up with some, you know, strange state. So yeah, I definitely agree that I think all of these approaches are valid. None of them are necessarily legacy. And even though it might be something new to you if you're used to some other approach, I think learning about these things also is very, very valuable.
Yeah, and I have an issue with the usage of the word obscure, because nothing about it is obscure. It's all documented and you can look at the documentation for it. Obscure implies that it's something you only know if you are part of a secret group or something.
Well, I mean, some parts of the Mac API, and this is true for certain parts of the iOS SDK
just to be clear, I'm not saying all of the AppKit documentation is perfect.
Yeah, that's a good caveat to add. But some parts of the SDKs, they do rely on some kind of informality, like these informal protocols that exist for both things like accessibility, and there's some NSObject stuff that is kind of more informal. They're not like concrete protocols. They're more like just extensions and categories. And these things can lead to ambiguity, and it can be hard to understand. And sometimes I joke about, you know, AppKit, and I say that, you know, it's an exclusive club, and once you become a member, you're a big fan of AppKit, but it takes a while to become a fully fledged member. Yeah. And, you know, so again, it's not necessarily that some of the APIs are good or bad or something like that. It's more maybe that they have different conventions. And, you know, like we talked about on the previous episode, familiarizing yourself with those conventions is usually key.
Mm-hmm. So another topic he mentioned is undo, that on the Mac you have the expectation that you'll have to deal with undo. And I agree, but like most apps don't really need undo. I've been doing Mac apps for a long time and I don't remember having to implement undo because it doesn't make sense. Like my WWDC for Mac app, you don't need undo for anything. I could probably add, like, if you favorite something and you want to undo the favorite, but it's not that useful. People will expect undo from productivity apps where you add stuff and delete stuff. Most apps you would port from iOS wouldn't need undo. Also, right. Another topic is device testing, that it's harder to test on other Macs. And again, I haven't had any issues on specific machines. They vary a lot less between Mac devices than they do with iOS devices. So again, it sounds like it's an issue, but it's not really. And there also the mention of deployment, that the Mac App Store is not as good as the iOS App Store, which I agree completely. But again, if you want to deploy yourself, it's not that hard. I mean, I'm a single person developer and I have an app, Browser Freedom, which is available as a external download and it has its own licensing thing. And you just use something like the FastSpring service for sales, mm-hmm. and it's very simple. So it's not a big deal. And you can sell separately, which is very cool. So I think his article has some very good points, but I don't agree with all of them.
Yeah, I think actually the distribution part there is pretty much like a strength for Mac development. It's the fact that you can actually, you know, sell apps on your own is, for me at least, like appealing when it comes to Mac development. It's like, well, I could have my own kind of licensing model, or I could have my own, you know, checkout, my own store. You know, I don't have to follow these, you know, specific rules, and I don't have to give Apple 30% necessarily. So yeah, there's a lot of flexibility there as well. But of course, with flexibility also comes complexity. So the iOS model is kind of more straightforward in that way.
Yep.
But yeah, great blog post there by Shaps. There'll be a link in the show notes if you want to check it out. And it's always really interesting to hear people's experiences, you know, moving between different platforms and some of the challenges you might face. And it's always good to read these kind of things also if you're looking to make a similar jump, because you can avoid some of the kind of rookie mistakes that you might otherwise be making.
Yeah.
Next up, we talked also last episode about a potential new declarative UI framework for Apple's platforms and, you know, the different kind of discussions in the community about, you know, whether that's plausible or not, whether it's going to happen this year or next year. And it looks like you found, Rambo, that Apple seems to be hiring for this position.
Yeah, so someone on Twitter, and by the way, this is pretty common for Apple employees on Twitter to post job offers, and if you're looking to work at Apple, you should pay attention to that. So someone on Twitter posted that Apple was hiring for, I don't remember exactly what division it was, but I opened the link and I started browsing job offers at Apple.com just to see what they were hiring, and because I know that sometimes you can find interesting stuff in there. And so let me just read a little piece of this job description. Your main focus will be designing, implementing, and communicating features that cross-cut the Swift language, our frameworks, and UI development practices. That grabbed my attention.
Yeah.
So Swift and frameworks and UI. Okay, that's interesting. But then you scroll down and you read the additional requirements. Swift, computer language grammars and parsers, functional programming style UI developments, framework API design, proposal, and development.
What could that be?
Functional programming style UI development.
Sounds suspicious.
So basically, Apple is hiring for their declarative UI framework project, and we'll leave the link in the show notes if you want to be a candidate for the position.
Yeah, you need to like marzipan.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll leave the link in the show notes and you can read that. I opened the link here and it doesn't seem like they took it down yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And this is something we see quite often where when Apple is ramping up something, it was the same like a couple of years ago when there was this rumors about Apple getting into like the car business. And they had all these job ads about like, you know, someone with experience developing automotive software and these kind of things like self-driving cars. And sometimes we can really see, you know, what is Apple focusing on depending on what people they hire. And, you know, that makes sense. And in this case, it seems like, yeah, they're trying to get some people in that have experience with, you know, some form of functional, maybe declarative UI frameworks. So yeah, that's super interesting. But again, I think it would also kind of confirm what we talked about, that this is not something that is coming, you know, in a couple of weeks at WWDC, but this is something that they are, you know, continuously working on right now for maybe next year or something like that.
Yeah, I was going to mention that the fact that they're hiring says a lot about the state of the project, because
yeah,
it probably started with people from inside Apple. So maybe even some engineer had this idea and made a demonstration for some manager, and then they said, oh, this is cool, let's do this. And then it probably started being developed inside Apple by engineers they already had, and now it's probably at the state where they are trying to make it shippable. So
yeah,
that's when they are hiring.
Yeah, exactly, ramping up development. All right, last piece of follow-up is a little bit about our Patreon. So we announced last episode that we are starting a Patreon. And first of all, we want to thank everyone who has, you know, become patrons and started supporting us and, you know, reaped some of the rewards that we have on our Patreon page. Again, it's a great way to support the show. It's just a couple of bucks per month, and it really helps when it comes to making the show more sustainable. We're currently at about 15% of reaching our goal of doing weekly episodes, which we are super excited about. So if you want to see this show becoming a weekly thing, then you know, head over to patreon.com/stacktracepod and become a patron. That would be super awesome. Now, we have a couple of news. Well, first of all, we want to really thank two of our patrons who have chosen the Good Friends of the Show tier, which is Harsh Dabai and Vigar. Thanks a lot for supporting us with $30 per month. That really makes a big difference for us. So thanks a lot. But we've had a lot of feedback from people, and that is that, you know, they like the show, they want to support us, they want to give us a few bucks per month, but maybe $30 is a bit too much. And, you know, we understand that. So we thought about it, and now we have announced or launched a new $5 tier. So, Rambo, why don't you tell us about the new The After Show tier?
Yeah, so we were thinking about what could we do for a reward, and we thought about, maybe we could do a live video or something. So that's what we're doing. So if you support us with the $5 tier, you will get access to the after show, which will be a monthly live video Q&A. We're going to do like just a regular hangout with our buddies from the after show.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And like we mentioned on the previous episode, we don't want to like make the show like exclusive or, you know, say that only every second episode is available to everyone. But we did want to create something that was, you know, really cool for our patrons and, you know, feels like, you know, a really cool reward, but without making the show exclusive itself. So we think that this video live Q&A is going to be really awesome and really fun. So we're doing the first one on the Tuesday of the WWDC week. So this will be your chance to ask us all the kinds of questions about the new SDK, about the new announcements, and, you know, really just hang out and discuss WWDC with us. We think it's going to be really, really awesome. So if you want to join, just head over to patreon.com/stacktracepod, check out our rewards, and whatever amount that you think you could help us with in order to make this show a weekly thing would be really, really awesome, and we appreciate it a lot.
Yeah, remember that you can customize your contribution on Patreon, so you can choose. You don't have to use exactly the amount we set as the tier.
All right, so that's it for follow-up. We're growing and growing with follow-up each episode, it seems. Yeah. So on this episode, we want to talk about what kind of happened during the last couple of weeks with Google I/O. There was Microsoft Build. And want to talk a little bit about how that may or may not influence kind of what Apple might be doing. Now, obviously, Apple, they have probably already decided what they're going to show at WWDC.
Yeah.
So I don't think they're going to change their plans for this year.
Yeah, I find it funny that sometimes Apple will come with things like a month after some other release, and the publications will say Apple is responding to what Google launched. No, they've been working on it for years.
Yeah, exactly. So we want to talk about that on this episode. We're not going to do so many predictions for WWDC this episode. That we're going to save for the next episode. So the next episode will be dedicated to WWDC predictions. But before we dive into Google I/O and Microsoft Build, let's talk about the iPhone SE.
Okay, tell me about the SE.
The SE is an amazing device. And it hasn't been updated in a while.
Yeah.
So there's been rumors that maybe there will be a new iPhone SE, maybe at WWDC, maybe at some other point. And the question is, will it adopt the iPhone X design language? And I know that you have some opinions about this, Guy.
Oh, boy.
Here we go.
Okay, so there are some mock-ups, and we'll definitely link to some of them. But I think it's important to control expectations, especially a month before WWDC. And I don't think it would make sense for Apple to release an iPhone SE that looks like an iPhone X and has an OLED screen and Face ID and wireless charging. Because when you think about it, the iPhone SE as it currently exists, it's a, and let me emphasize, quote, cheap phone, okay? It's not, I know it's not cheap. Nothing Apple makes is cheap, but it is the
cheaper.
Yeah, it's their, let's say, affordable phone. Let me use that word. So the iPhone SE is supposed to be an entry-level device that has good internals with a good processor, fast performance, good battery life. But for the external components, they usually go for stuff they probably have in inventory that they need to use, screens that are not the most recent ones. And I really wouldn't expect it to have Face ID. When you think about it, they released iPhone X with iPhone 8 and iPhone 8 Plus. iPhone 8 and 8 Plus, they don't have Face ID. It doesn't make any sense for them to release an iPhone SE with Face ID, which is the, again, quote, cheap phone, before they release regular iPhones with Face ID, if you know what I mean. So I really don't think, if they do release a new iPhone SE, with which I think they should and will, I would expect it to be the exact same device, maybe with the new generation Touch ID, the better Touch ID, and with iPhone 7 internals. I think that's what makes sense economically and technically for them to do.
Yeah, because there are really two things at play here. Like, first of all, we have like the target price point. So, you know, how do you get a phone to be less expensive, more affordable, cheaper, you know, whatever phrasing you want to use. How do you do that? Well, there are really two ways. And the first one is to use older components. Like you mentioned, you know, they've been using like older internals. They've been maybe reusing some inventory. In this case, they might reuse some things from the iPhone 7 era, because if they now in the spring will launch, you know, the next generation of phones, which is very, very likely, they will probably drop the iPhone 7 because, or the 6S or something like that. Like, one of the phones at the bottom of the line will drop. And, you know, they still probably have inventory of those components. So being able to reuse those is a way to kind of push the price down. And the second way is really to reuse the same process. So the reason, like, you know, phones that have been in production for a while are cheaper to manufacture is because they have kind of perfected that process and they've removed things that might be costly in the beginning. So, you know, if you think about it from that perspective, it would be very unlikely that the iPhone SE uses like some crazy new form factor, because that would inherently make it more expensive.
The iPhone SE, the current one, is basically iPhone 6S in a 5S body with a 5S screen. So I think what makes sense is for them to keep using the same form factor, but upgraded with iPhone 7 internals and maybe 3D touch, maybe not, maybe the better Touch ID sensor. Again, maybe not. I think the focus is a very good device. The current iPhone SE is still a very good device. It's very fast, but with components they've been using for a long time, so they are less expensive to manufacture.
Yeah.
Again, I need to make it clear, because people understand what they want to understand. I'm not saying I wouldn't love for them to release an iPhone SE with Face ID and all the cool stuff, but we have to control our expectations so we don't get disappointed. And I think expecting an iPhone SE with Face ID, and again, another clarification, I'm talking about this year. I'm not talking about next year. So maybe next year they do release an iPhone SE with Face ID, but I don't think this year we should expect it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, ideally, the form factor wouldn't really dictate the feature set. So you should be able to select a, you know, bigger phone, a medium phone, or a smaller phone, and you can still get all the cool features. But, you know, in reality, that's really not the way it works, because, well, if the phone, again, is going to be cheaper, then, you know, different components need to be used. And there's also like physical limitations. Like, the reason the iPhone 10 can have better battery life to some extent is because it's larger. So you can just fit more battery in there. So I think it's also kind of right now a little bit unrealistic with the kind of current technology we have that the smaller phone will have the exact same specs as the higher end phone or the bigger phone, because then that would just mean that there was wasted potential in the bigger phone.
Another aspect people tend to ignore is thermal capabilities. So if you have a larger body on the phone, you can dissipate more heat. So you can have dual cameras with portrait mode and 60 FPS 4K movie recording. If you have a smaller body, you maybe can't do that because the battery will overheat and it will explode.
Yeah, exactly. Another aspect of this whole thing is also kind of the branding side of the iPhone X. And it's very funny because now we've also seen Android phones come out with a notch that don't really need to have a notch because they don't have anything under there. But it's a branding thing, right? And the iPhone X, I mean, you were the one discovering kind of the glyphs and the kind of core animation assets in the HomePod firmware before the iPhone X was announced. And the kind of distinguishing feature on those glyphs was the notch, right? So it's not only a kind of, you know, question about cost or feature set, it's also a question of like, what's the iPhone X brand versus the kind of quote-unquote normal iPhone brand?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this will probably change this year when they release the flagship phones for this year in probably September. But before then, I wouldn't expect another device to have this appearance of a notch and no home button.
Yeah, I totally agree. Another piece of news that came out, I think it was last week, was about Twitter and their new API that they're launching and the pricing for that new API. And this is something that has caused a lot of discussion in the community because the new API that they're launching, which is a requirement if you want to implement like more real-time features in a third-party Twitter app, they call it the new account activity APIs. It was, well, kind of expensively priced. Just for as an example, if you have 250 users of your app, you need to pay Twitter $2,899 per month to use this API.
Ouch.
What do you think about this, Guy?
Ouch is what I think of it. Wow. So the issue is third-party clients currently use a streaming API from Twitter to provide you streaming timeline and notifications, all the good stuff. And they are shutting down that API, and they were originally going to shut down before releasing this new API. So the third-party client developers complained, and many people got into this complaint of Twitter is trying to shut down third-party clients. And then Twitter said, oh, no, don't worry. We are going to make sure you get access to the API before we deprecate the old one. And now they have released the documentation for the new API, but it's more than $2,000 per month for 250 users. And I'm not an expert, but I think third-party Twitter clients have way more than 250 users.
Yeah, I don't think you need to be an expert to estimate that. I think that's reasonable. This is, obviously, some people, they look at this and they get kind of shocked and they're like, this was, really surprising and this was, an outrage. And of course, like, I can understand why a lot of people are upset about this because, some people, they really love their third-party Twitter apps and some people, they wouldn't use Twitter without being able to use apps like Tweetbot or Twitterific. But at the same time, this is kind of a trend that's been happening now for quite a long time. And for like years, Twitter has made the viability of third-party clients kind of lower and lower and making it harder and harder to actually use Twitter as a third-party client in a viable way. So I'm personally not really shocked by this. I think that it was something that we've seen coming. It's of course like a shame that this is happening, and it really, if you're developing one of these apps or if you love one of these apps, I can understand why you might be really upset. But at the same time, like, this is something that Twitter has been like continuously moving to for quite a long time.
Yeah, I what bothers me the most is how they are doing this, but not really doing it explicitly. I think they should just be honest and say, we don't want third-party clients. You guys go get out of my lawn, kind of thing.
yeah, exactly.
I think doing it this way, I think it was Gruber who mentioned that you want to break up with your partner, and instead of just breaking up, you start being a dick.
Yeah. It's very passive aggressive, right? It's very like, or even just aggressive. It's very like you're saying one thing, but you're doing a completely different thing.
Yeah,
you're saying,
and then,
like, oh, don't worry.
They post to their forums like, oh, we're sorry, it's not our intention, blah, blah, blah. I mean, just be honest. And again, speaking for myself, I'm not going to miss notifications, which is what this is going to affect, because I don't use notifications. I don't like notifications. I have notifications disabled for pretty much everything on both my phone and my computer. So I only get really important notifications, like iMessages from John. And
thank you.
Yeah, and I mean, you are a heavy user of Twitter and you have lots of followers. You know that we can't use notifications. We would, our screens would be just notifications if we turn them on. I know people have notifications on for likes. I post something to Twitter, and especially if it's some juicy Apple leak stuff, and I have a Tweetbot with the sidebar showing the activity, and it just goes blah, starts scrolling like crazy, and I even made the app crash one time because of that. So
Tweetbot can't handle your scale.
And I have like 20,000 followers. Imagine if you have millions of followers. But again, I think it's a bummer, and they should be more honest about it and just say they don't want third-party clients. And I'm not sure if I would keep using Twitter if I couldn't use Tweetbot, to be honest. I would have to think hard about it.
Yeah, I guess I'm weird in this case, because I am only using Twitter through all of their first-party channels. So I'm not using any third-party app. And this might be why my kind of reaction to this is a bit different. Again, I want to make it clear that I don't think this is good. I think it's a shame.
You're just lucky that you're
not
affected.
I'm just lucky that I'm not affected. Yeah, exactly. But also one thing that I think is interesting to do is kind of try to make sense of it from a strategy perspective. And you know, it's kind of clear, or at least to me, it's clear what it looks like, and it definitely looks like somewhere inside Twitter, there was a decision made kind of at the strategy or executive level that, you know, we want to funnel all of our users into our first party clients. And by that, I mean the first party apps that they have on mobile and the web, which is basically their first party offering on desktop. And, you know, this, we can debate whether that's a good decision or whether it's going to end up, you know, ruining the service, whether they're going to lose too many users. But this to me is like, this is what it definitely looks like what their strategy is, to just move all users to the first party apps. And, you know, the reasons for that might be, you know, we can only monetize these users if they're on the first party service or the first party apps. It's less code to maintain. You know, there can be many different reasons, but of course, like, these kind of transitions is always tricky, because you launched a platform to be very, very open and encourage people to build third-party apps on top of the platform. And that was a big reason for Twitter's success in the early days. And now you want to kind of lock things down, which is kind of, you know, that's not the principles that the service kind of got big on, right?
Yeah, and we should probably do a show about how the web is getting more and more closed, because it used to be this very open thing. And it makes me very sad that so much of the web has become just browsing Facebook, and how much of the web only works in Google Chrome. And it reminds me of the Internet Explorer 6 days. It makes me very sad. And I think people should worry about this more than they are, but that's a topic for another show.
Yeah, it's a very interesting topic, and I agree with you. It's like, back in the day, we were also talking about, you know, a different type of scale, and we're talking about different volumes of traffic. Because like running an open API now, if you have a lot of traffic, is very expensive. So back in the day, it was like standard, like, yeah, of course, like, you know, I have an RSS feed, I have this, I have that, you know. But now we see, like you say, we see so many of these services kind of closing down, maybe for financial reasons, maybe just to be able to control things, maybe to like, you know, secure their future, but they might also be jeopardizing it at the same time. But yeah, we're going to keep an eye on this and see what's going to happen. But like from a developer's perspective, it's of course always sad to see these nice rich APIs being locked down, either, you know, behind a paywall or, you know, removed completely, because, you know, it's always fun to build these kind of, you know, scripts and apps and stuff like that on top of APIs like Twitter.
Yeah, Twitter clients used to be the standard iOS app that everyone would write when they were learning iOS development. I don't know if you remember that era.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a lot of them.
Yeah.
like to-do apps and Twitter clients, right?
Yeah, and even I think it's the sample app they build in that Stanford iOS development course.
Right, yeah.
So it's sad that they're closing down the API.
Yeah, I mean, imagine the way I like to think about these things, again, because I'm not super affected, but I'm just thinking about this particular thing. But I'm just thinking, like, what if GitHub would do the same thing?
Ooh.
What if GitHub would start shutting down their API? Like, so many of my tools that I've built are relying on the GitHub API being an open API. And it would be, you know, again, I don't have any like financial interest in these tools. It was, you know, something mostly I've shared with the community for fun. But you know, it would suck. It would be terrible, and it would be not as much fun, and I couldn't be as productive and build these kind of tools if, you know, I had to pay $2,000 to use the GitHub API, right?
Yeah, if GitHub wanted to, they could break the internet tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right. All right, so now on to different things. Like we mentioned in the intro, we want to talk about Google I/O and Microsoft Build. And even though, you know, we are a kind of Apple-focused podcast, it's very interesting to look at these kind of competitors to Apple or different tech companies and see what they do. And, you know, again, talk about how that might either influence Apple in the future, or, you know, how Apple will be perceived when they will have their own conference, WWDC, in like the next couple of weeks. So we're going to put links in the show notes. If you haven't watched Google I/O or Microsoft Build, there are great videos by The Verge and Engadget, which basically takes these, you know, press conferences and keynotes and boils them down to like, you know, 15 minutes or less. So have a look at those if you want to get up to speed on what happened at these two conferences.
There's one aspect of these conferences that someone mentioned in another podcast, but I don't remember which one. But we, of course, are Apple nerds, so we care a lot about WWDC, and we always watch the keynotes, preferably live. And we get like shocked when someone doesn't know that WWDC is going on. And when these other companies, which we don't follow as closely, do their developer conferences, we don't really pay attention. Like during the Google I/O thing, I noticed people talking about it on Twitter, but I was like, whatever. Not because I don't like Google necessarily, but because I'm not on their ecosystem. So the stuff they release is not that important to my daily life. But I think we should pay attention to what they're doing. And that's what we're doing today.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's like, you know, might set certain directions in the industry, because, you know, even if you're not an Android user, there's no denying like Google is a huge force in the tech industry. And the same thing is true for Microsoft in, you know, different kind of areas. I mean, as mobile developers, sometimes we're dismissing Microsoft a bit these days because they don't have a mobile platform, you know, of size. But they do a lot of other interesting things, and they are huge in other areas. So I think, yeah, like you say, paying a little bit of attention at least is probably healthy, also just to see what's going on the other side of the fence.
Yeah, and also so we can ask Apple to copy the cool stuff we like.
Exactly.
People have this approach to technology sometimes, where they will say things like, oh, but Apple did it first or Google did it first. But I honestly, who cares who did it first? I care if I have access to it. And
yeah, and who did it better?
Yeah, that's also a good point. But I don't think we should. It's not a race to see who does something first. I think if you're in the Apple ecosystem, of course, it's cool when Apple does brand new stuff that's not been done before. But if they do something that's been done before by either Google, Apple, Amazon, whatever, it's good for you because you're going to have access to that cool feature on your ecosystem that you're used to and that you like.
Yeah, and competition really kind of fosters innovation in the space. Mm-hmm. Like if Apple becomes too big, and some might argue that they already are too big, but if Apple is like, you know, continuously growing and becoming dominant, too dominant, then they're going to slow down innovation. That always happens. So having this like really highly competitive market in tech, I think is super good. And one area where there's a lot of competition and where arguably Apple might be, you know, in a position where they need to catch up is AI. So both Microsoft and Google, they put a really heavy focus on AI during their keynote presentations. So Microsoft, they were announcing everything from autonomous drones. They had the next generation of the Kinect camera, which can connect to their cloud. And they had speech recognition and bots and brainwave technology. And, you know, they were auto-translating meetings in real time. So there were a lot of cool stuff that Microsoft showed. But I think in terms of AI, the things that, you know, everyone has been talking about for the last week or so is the Google Duplex demo. So, Rambo, why don't you give us a little quick summary of what happened and what is this Google Duplex?
So, basically, Google Duplex is something that calls for you and makes appointments. So, the demo they showed was of this Google Duplex system calling a hair salon to make an appointment. And it sounds like a person is making the appointment. It's very impressive and very cool. So yeah, so basically that's it. It's an AI system that can make appointments for you. And their demo is extremely impressive.
Yeah, and the way they do this, we'll put a link in the show notes to the video if you still haven't seen it. But the way they do it is that they basically take their existing technology for text-to-speech and they just made it sound a lot more natural or a lot more like a human would speak. They add ums and ahs and they add things like, oh really? Or, let me check that. You know, like these kind of more different sounds that we humans make when we are thinking or when we are rephrasing something. And that was both, you know, very impressive. So there's been this like wave in the community during like the last week or so where at first people were like extremely impressed by this technology. And it's like, wow, it feels like science fiction. We can't believe that we already have the technology to build something like this. And then people were like, but wait a second. Is this really good? Like, is this really good for humanity or good for us or good for the technology industry? And people were discussing a little bit about the ethics about this as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've said now a couple of times, we try to not dive too much into like the political or ethical or what have you nature of things. We like to talk about kind of the technical aspects, but this is something I feel like we need to talk about the ethics.
Yeah.
Because it's so kind of far out when it comes to, you know, what it can do. And it's the first time you really see something like so convincingly human-like. So what are your thoughts about this, Rambo?
So first thing, I don't think people should, if you're a Google fan, you shouldn't feel bad because this has sparked this ethical debate. I think the fact that it has initiated this debate is a proof of just how breakthrough this technology is. We wouldn't be talking about the ethical aspect if it wasn't a really amazing breakthrough. So just keep that in mind. The technical side of it is just fabulous. So don't worry about it. We don't think it's not technically good, but the ethical aspect that bothered most people, and including myself, is should the AI sound so much like a human to the point that the person on the other side of the phone doesn't really know? Aren't we tricking the other person when we do this?
Yeah, exactly. And there was this suggestion that, or rather feedback that, why is even Google trying to trick people? Like, why isn't the Google Assistant identifying itself as the Google Assistant or as an AI or as a robot or something like that? Why is it just saying like, hi, I'm calling on behalf of a client, you know, pretending to basically be a real human assistant instead of, you know, being an AI? So this is like the big debate that's been going on. Yeah. And so the question is like, why are Google doing this? Like, why are they trying to trick people? Is it just for demonstration purposes? Is it just for the shock and awe effect? Or is this something that they are genuinely going to put in the product?
Yeah, they actually said after it sparked this debate that they are going to change the implementation so it makes it clear that it's the Google Duplex system that's calling. And I think that that's good. And something people said about the, it shouldn't say it's an AI because then people would just hang up or would try to trick it. But you don't have to sound like an AI to say that you are an AI. It could just say, hey, I'm Lisa's Google assistant.
Yeah,
that's it. That's enough. So it doesn't have to sound like a robot. It just has to explain that it's a robot.
Yeah, and it's pretty funny to me also because this kind of keeps happening with Google demos. Like last year, they did a demo where they had this new chat service, like or video calling service, and the key feature was that you can see the camera, you can see the live video before someone has picked up. And then, you know, people were debating like, well, will they be able to see me when I'm in the shower? And, you know, all these kind of things. And the fact that Google didn't address that, they didn't like say anything about it. They just show the demo. It was kind of the same thing there. And here is that people, instead of talking about the cool tech, people start questioning like the ethics or, you know, the problems or things like that that are going to come with it. So I just find it kind of, you know, funny or ironic that like history repeats itself.
Yeah, and in that case, it wasn't something breakthrough or even useful, but in this case, it is. I hope we did this podcast in Portuguese because we have a slang in Portuguese that could be used for this situation, but I'm going to try and translate it. We sometimes say when companies do this that they don't have a shit will happen department. a department in the company that will see something like this and say, hey, we can't release this like this because it will happen.
Yeah.
I think that's a very good term.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's been like the number one question. Like, you know, presumably a lot of people saw this demo and worked on this demo before it was public, and you know, you're asking yourself, like, at some point, didn't someone at least think about these questions? You know, maybe we should identify that that the assistant is, in fact, the Google Assistant. But at the same time, I also think that, you know, a lot of the, again, the initial kind of awe of this demo was kind of the fact that these people on the other end of the phone were kind of tricked into believing that it was an AI. That was kind of the, you know, that was the demonstration effect. That was like the cool effect. And of course, like, you know, we can discuss the ethics of that. But I think that in this case, Google made this decision because it just made for a better demo.
Could we say that their AI passed the Turing test?
I guess. It's like, it's really crazy, right? Like, I mean, we could have done this podcast like 2 years ago and we could have heard some rumors about this and we would probably have said, no way, that's like, it's way further into the future.
Yeah, I think it's really impressive. If they manage to make it less creepy, I think it's going to be very cool. And the part of this that I think it is most interesting and I think can make a huge difference is in accessibility. So if a person has some issue where they can't talk, they can use this to make appointments and stuff. So I think we can't ignore the accessibility aspect of this.
Yeah, or if you're in a different country, like for example, I live in Poland, and here it's not super common that people working in certain industries, or maybe, you know, when you're calling like some government office, it's not super common that these people always speak English or are always comfortable speaking English. So in that case, maybe it would be better for everyone involved if I actually just had my Google Assistant call them. And again, it's, you know, you can have your thoughts about this, and I certainly am conflicted about whether or not I would actually end up using something like this, because you also don't want to end up being like, oh, I'm so lazy, I, you know, I'm not going to learn this language, or, you know, I can't be bothered to call and set up a hair appointment, so I'm just going to, you know, automate that because I don't care about these people answering the phone. So because I definitely don't feel that way, and I wouldn't use it for something like my hair salon, because I have a great relationship with these people. So it would just be very weird if all of a sudden, like, an assistant calls, right?
Yeah, they could be offended.
Yeah, I mean, they would probably wonder what's going on. Like, you know, John, did you get yourself an assistant? Like, are you that important? And, you know, so there are really a lot of challenges here, both in terms of, you know, how do you, you know, how do we value human interaction? You know, is it okay to have an AI just call somebody? Is that, you know, is it okay for the AI to pretend to be human? You know, what kind of relationship do you have with people when you are, you know, like going to get your hair cut or going to a restaurant? You know, there are so many kind of ethical and philosophical discussions here to be had. So I really hope Google doesn't rush this to market, and I hope that we can have a lot of discussions about this and come up with some good ground rules for how this technology is to be used. But, you know, either way, it's a really, really impressive demo.
There's also the aspect where we could say they are making a faster horse, because how often do you really have to talk on the phone these days? I do it so rarely that when my phone actually rings, when it's a phone call, I get kind of stunned. What's this? What's this noise my phone's making? Because it's very yeah, rare exactly. for me to have to speak on the phone. I think that there's that as well. How useful is this? And of course, I'm talking from a perspective of someone who lives in a big city with technology all around. And there are, of course, places in the world where calling on the phone is more necessary and is used more. But then in those places, are people even going to have access to this?
Yeah. Is it going to be English only, or, you know, is it going to be multilingual? And yeah, it's again, very, very challenging. And I still think that it's a cool thing that we are, you know, progressing and we're developing this kind of technology as an industry. But again, we need to make sure that it's used in like a way that is, you know, ethical and sustainable for society as well. So that, you know, people working in certain industries, like answering the phone, are not just becoming like human bots, right?
Yeah, human APIs.
Yeah, exactly. That would just be terrible. So challenging times. So yeah, there was a heavy focus on AI, and Microsoft, they also did a pretty interesting thing. They have integrated the Amazon Alexa and their Cortana assistant. And I thought this would be a little bit interesting to talk about as well, because now you can use these two assistants together, and you can like summon Cortana from your Amazon Echo. You can summon Amazon's assistant from Windows. And this is all kind of just crazy because, you know, you were asking one of your assistants to please fetch the other assistant.
Well, this is a phrase that you wouldn't expect to hear from anyone in the early 2000s, I guess. But I love how open Microsoft is.
Yeah, exactly. It's crazy what like a complete turnaround they've done in terms of their strategy and how they work.
Apple would absolutely never do something like this. And yeah. I like that Microsoft is doing it.
Yeah, but I mean, at the same time, it's like, you know, when you are in a position of power, you can be more closed and you can be more opinionated and you can do whatever you want because you're in a position of power. And Microsoft obviously are feeling, you know, a little bit threatened maybe, and are doing these more open initiatives and partnering with more companies because they kind of have to, right?
Yeah, and we're going to talk more about this when we mention the App Store pricing thing.
Yeah, exactly. But what I think is interesting to discuss is, you know, all these things we've talked about. There's the Google Duplex. There is these, you know, assistants talking and working together. There is, you know, lots of AI technology coming out of Microsoft. These AI strategies are, you know, very, very strong in many cases, and they're very, very forward thinking. And then we have Apple, and, you know, we haven't seen yet what Apple is going to do. And this is the topic for next episode, of course, when we're going to speculate about that. But how far behind are Apple in terms of their AI strategy and their AI implementation? Will Siri be able to catch up on all these things?
I think you mentioned the key phrase, which is forward thinking. And when we talk about Apple, we never know what's forward because Apple will not say it to us. And I think many times when these feelings of Apple is behind come up is because they are not talking about what they're doing. And we don't know what's coming in a month with WWDC. We don't know what's coming at the end of the year or next year, which some of these other companies do. Microsoft, Google, Amazon, they talk about what they're doing, and some of the things they announce are not going to be released for a long time, but they're talking about them already.
Or they're in beta for like 2 years or something
like
that.
Yeah, and I don't think that's necessarily good or bad. I honestly prefer the way Apple does things usually. Unfortunately, it's not always, but I think it's still most of the time they announce something and it's released right away or a month after that, a couple of weeks. They have been doing this thing that I don't like of announcing things a year before they're released, like HomePod, AirPower. I think they should stop doing that and announce stuff when it's ready.
Yeah.
But with that said, I remember, I don't know if it was a year ago, 2 years, how many years ago it was, there was this real feeling around the tech circles that Apple was behind on AI and machine learning. And then they released Caramel and all of the cool stuff they are doing now, and people stopped talking about it. And now with these new releases, again, this topic comes up, is Apple behind on AI? And I honestly yeah. don't know. Currently, of course, from our perspective, from what we can see, they are, but who knows what they're working on? We will never know what they're working on. We will only know when they release them. So, I don't know. They are, of course, from the current perspective, but they are probably working on something really cool that we'll only see next year, maybe. So, yeah, let's see what they come up with.
Yeah, I think one thing that kind of informs this or contributes to this perspective or this idea that Apple is behind is kind of the trajectory that has happened the last couple of years when it comes to the development of AI. So if you look at Siri, like Siri was introduced in iOS 5 or something like that, right? Like many, many years
ago.
Yeah,
it was with the iPhone 4S.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was iOS 5. And at the time, it was really, really cool. It was very limited, but it was really cool. And now, like 6 years later or something like that, it is still pretty cool and pretty limited. And I think that during this whole time, we've seen things like Microsoft, you know, Cortana, we've seen Amazon get into the game, the Echo has come out, you know, all these things have happened. And I think we have this perception that so many things have happened in the industry in general, but not so many things have happened with Siri. And I know, like, Siri has gained abilities and she can, you know, tell sports scores or, you know, some things like that. There's definitely been improvements, but we're not seeing these, like, leaps in terms of, you know, how good it is, how good it is at understanding you, how kind of quote-unquote intelligent it seems to be. And I think that this is the concern that a lot of people have.
Yeah, the feeling I have about Siri, it is that it's a legacy system that's hacky and...
It's using target action.
Probably. Some obscure APIs. And yeah. That if they're not working on a replacement, basically, then they are probably in a very bad place. Because after that article came out talking about the development of Siri and how it was rushed, and it was the classical development story of, oh, let's refactor later, and then the refactor yeah. never comes, and it becomes a huge mess. And I think that reflects in the quality of the system. And if they are not working on a big replacement for Siri that can still be called Siri, but maybe they should choose another name, then I think they are in a very bad position. But they've been hiring lots of people. They acquired an AI person from Google, and I think they are probably working on something that's probably not going to be released this year, but maybe next year. Don't know. I hope.
They should just go ahead and hire the Google Assistant, Alexa, and Cortana.
Maybe.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. And it's going to be interesting to see if Core ML, like, opens up a little bit more, or if, like, you know, we get new APIs, for example, to do on-device learning and things like that. Or, you know, if we get a new way to create machine learning models and things like that. But again, we're going to save it for next episode. But it's really interesting to see what Apple is going to do in this space. And I don't think the battle is over. I think definitely there's a lot of things Apple can do. And I think Apple has a lot of advantages here as well. Like, they are really, really good at doing machine learning with privacy in mind. And if they can make a similar kind of leap forward with privacy in mind, with security in mind, it could be really, really powerful.
Yeah, we managed to record for more than an hour without mentioning how Google doesn't worry about privacy. So let me say it now. As much as I love the technical aspects of what they announced, I wouldn't use any of it because of privacy concerns, as we mentioned before right. in this podcast.
Another really cool trend that we saw both from Microsoft and Google was the fact that they're introducing new APIs for an app to render a surface inside another context. So Google, they're introducing a new Slices API in Android, where you can take a part of your app, like a slice, they call it, and render it somewhere else. And the example they gave was being able to, like, call a Lyft, like using the Lyft ride-sharing service, right from in Google Search, like right from the Google Search app. So you don't have to switch apps in order to perform an app-specific action. And the same thing for Microsoft. They announced something new called Adaptive Cards, which is apparently an open source format. And the example they gave was so that you could pay your invoices right from Outlook. So you get an email with an invoice and you can just click a button to pay it right there. And this is something that I find super interesting. And I've been thinking about this for many years now that, you know, I would love for apps to more be portable in the sense that they can be rendered in more contexts. And Apple has done some things in this area. They have the extensions APIs, you can create widgets with, you know, a today widget, but we're still not able to, like, summon a view controller, like, from another app and just render it in our app. And I think something like that would be potentially very, very powerful. So it's really cool to see both Microsoft and Google doing something like this. So what do you think about this approach, Guy? And is this something you think could be useful on iOS as well?
Yeah, first of all, I think it's really interesting the term in-context app surfaces, because there's this API on iOS called IO Surface, which is basically a way for you to render content from another process in and show it in your process. So I think it's interesting, the word surface. And
right, and that's what is being used by Safari and the image picker and things like that, right? That you can get a view controller to put in your view hierarchy in your app to, you know, show Safari, but it's actually not rendered in your process.
Yeah, there's lots of that on iOS. And the API they have for view services are really view controllers that show up on another process. When you ask for location permissions on your app, the alert that shows up is not running on your process. It's rendered by another process, of course, so you can't mess with it and inspect the UI and click the button for the user.
Change the label.
Yeah. And
do you want free puppies?
Yes. Another thing that works like that is the UI for when you have your AirPods near your iPhone. It shows up on top of Springboard, and that's another process that's rendering it. So iOS has the technology for it. It already supports extensions. I think a really cool thing Apple could do would be to enable third-party apps to define their own extension points. So let's say on my app, Chibi Studio, I want some other app to be able to render a little view controller on some place to do something. I could define my own extension point and another app could render in there. And I think they have all they need in there. All the tech is already working, so they only need to allow developers to use it and make it accessible to developers. So I don't think it's a stretch to think that Apple will enable this.
Yeah, exactly. And it's something I think that could, because people are always talking about like how to become really productive on an iPad, for example, or how to be really productive on iOS. And I think this is like a, could potentially be a big piece of that puzzle. Like on the Mac, we're used to being productive by running multiple windows and dragging things around and, you know, alt tabbing? No. And, you know, command tabbing. I'm on Windows for some reason. All this talk about Microsoft.
You're contaminated.
Exactly. into different apps and being productive that way. But imagine if we could, you know, have these like really cool workflows on iOS where we could just like string multiple apps together. And I know there's like the workflow app that you could use this way with, you know, URLs and things like that. But imagine like a completely native, safe way to do this and handing off this data between different apps. That could be super cool. And it could also be a solution to a very commonly requested feature on iOS, which is to set your own default app. Like, to be able to open web links in Chrome or to use another email client or something like that. And if we were able to define these more extension points, we could make that happen.
Yeah, and I really think iOS apps are too monolithic at the moment. We talked about this before the show. I don't like the fact that, for instance, if you want to do background location tracking, you have to run basically the entire app in the background. Why can't it be just a separate little extension that only does that? It reminds me of the notification extensions API, which are a separate process that all it does is parse the notification that came in, configure the content for display, and that's it. That's all it does. You don't have to run your entire app in the background to do something simple. And I really think iOS could benefit from an architecture like this.
Yeah, I think it would be super interesting. And it would really, you know, make for an interesting paradigm shift in the way that iOS apps are architected. I know some people, they are building apps that rely heavily on extensions, like they have 12 different targets with different extensions. They need to architect their app in a different way. And, You know, right now, some of this stuff is kind of cumbersome because, you know, you could pull things out like into a separate framework, but then how do you share data? You need to like write to a container on disk. It would be cool to get some different APIs in the sense too, to be able to more easily connect these pieces and to say like, you know, here's how I communicate with the parent app, or maybe you have some central process running that acts as like the hub, like the connection point between like the UI that the app is rendering and the notification or location extension, etc.
Yeah, in fact, there's already a process on iOS that does that. I think it's XPC proxy or something that handles mm-hmm. all of the cross-process communication APIs. And you could be using that on your app if it wasn't private. Of course, there are concerns of battery life and stuff, but I really think Apple should be thinking about enabling this API for third-party developers. And by the way, on the Mac, you can already do that.
Yeah, you can have a daemon running or something like that.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be a daemon. It can be something that's spawned on demand. So let's say you have something your app does that is, I don't know, crash-prone, very heavy processing of stuff. You could spawn...
Like running SourceKit.
Yeah. You could spawn a separate process for that. My WWDC app for macOS, it has to download and index transcripts for the sessions. And that's a very heavy operation. So it spawns a separate process that does it in the background. So it doesn't bog down the UI, and it doesn't, if it crashes or something because a malformed JSON, not that it will crash because of that, but if it happens, it's not going to bring down the entire app with it. So,
yeah.
And there are also security benefits because your process, your background process can have very limited permissions to only the things it has to do. So it might even not have access to the disk or the network. And I think that that's really interesting.
Yeah. I also think, like, obviously there are challenges when it comes to battery life, but done right, it could potentially help battery life. Because like you mentioned, right now, if I want to observe the user's location or I want to continue playing audio in the background, I have to run the entire app, right?
Yeah.
But if we could have that as a, like a little extension that only has a very small memory footprint, it doesn't need to render any UI, it just acts like as a service, then you could potentially just run that service and that would actually improve battery life.
Yeah, and they can be very aggressive on the memory limitations. The extension for notifications I mentioned earlier, it has, I think, a 5 megabyte memory limit. So if you go beyond that, it just gets killed.
Yeah. So super interesting stuff. I think this is in general kind of where things are heading in terms of, you know, new widgets and creating more different kind of extension points. I mean, Apple is doing it. Google and Microsoft are doing it as well. And it seems like we're kind of slowly but surely kind of leaving the app metaphor as the only interaction point for our apps. And I think that's pretty cool. The final piece of news that we wanted to talk about on this episode is a little bit about Microsoft's changes in pricing and their revenue share. So we mentioned earlier that Microsoft, they've made a change, or they're going to make a change, where if you are building a quote-unquote consumer app, which is not a game and not a quote-unquote commercial app, then you get 85% of the revenue instead of just 70%. And if you are referring customers into the store yourself, like say you are running your own website and then you have a link there to buy the app on the Microsoft store, you get 95%. So this is a big change. And again, it's something Microsoft are incentivized to do because their store is not the most popular store in the world. So the question is, would Apple ever consider doing something like this? And, you know, is this something we could expect to see in the future? What do you think, Guy?
Oh, man, would I love.
It's a sweet, sweet 95%.
Oh, yeah. It's really tough because I have an app that makes money, Chibi Studio, and it's hard because you make 70% of what Apple... what you're making. So Apple takes 30%. And then the money gets sent to my country. and I pay 6% tax because of the international transfer of money. And on top of that, I pay my taxes. So I'm not going to do the calculation here now, but I probably...
Welcome to Accountancy with Rambo.
I probably make like 50% of what people actually, from what people pay my app, is what actually gets to my bank account. So it's hard. It's, you have to sell a lot to really make a profit.
Yeah, and then you have combined with this the fact that software is like going down in price, a lot of apps are free, and it's hard to even get people to pay for software in the first place.
Yeah, most of our reviews that are not 5 stars are people complaining that they have to pay for stuff.
Yeah.
So I would love for Apple to do it. Do I think they will? No.
Yeah, again, it's like Apple is in a position of power here. They're doing really well with their store. And, you know, we could argue how well they're actually doing, because a lot of the revenue is coming from a small amount of apps, right? You have your Clash of Clans and, I don't know, all these games that are very, very profitable, and they have in-app purchases. They have, you know, these kind of gambling mechanics, and we can talk about, you know, ethics there as well. But Apple, at the end of the day, is making a lot of money from the App Store. You know, it's a very popular platform. A lot of developers are building for it. So the question is, like, what's the incentive for Apple to change this? And they have been playing around with different revenue structures. Like, now, if you have a subscription-based app, you actually get a larger cut if your users renew their subscription after a year.
Yeah, that's cool. And the example you gave here on our show notes, I think it's a very good one, because it's one where Apple is not necessarily in a position of power when you consider the platform. Because you said that maybe if they do some cross-platform App Store thing and you make your app to both Mac and iOS under a single product in the App Store, maybe then they could incentivize developers to do that by taking a smaller cut. I think that's a good example where Apple might do something, but I still think they wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of ways to incentivize people to develop for a platform. And one is the developer experience. And we talked about that on previous episodes about, you know, this rumored Marzipan framework, and, you know, maybe they're going to make it easier to build UIs for both the Mac and iOS. But there's also the financial aspect. If you could get a larger cut, if you also ship your app on the Mac, that could incentivize people to do both. And that would be great for Apple. It would be great for developers. It would be great for users. So this is something that I see as more likely. I don't think they're going to voluntarily give up their money on iOS, but to drive the growth of the Mac platform, that might be something they might do.
Yeah, and there's also the aspect that we don't need to get much into, but we don't know how much it costs to maintain the App Store. I expect it to be a huge amount of money.
Yeah, I mean, probably Tim Cook can afford it, right?
Yeah, but like companies, their job is to make a profit, and Apple's margins have always been very high, and it's not like, oh, they have the money, so they should just run it at a loss. I don't think that's fair.
It's not a charity. And also, we have to remember that different departments in big companies, they have different targets, and they have different metrics that they're being, you know, measured by. So even if like Apple sells a lot of iPhones, the App Store can't just go, you know, bankrupt because it's being run probably, I don't know the exact details of how Apple is structured financially, but I would assume that if the App Store were to go with a loss, some people in the management chain might not be so happy about that.
Yeah, probably. So they can't afford that.
All right, I think that's it for this episode. So it was a lot of fun talking about these things and speculating about what might happen. But there's going to be a lot more speculation on the next episode, where we're going to make our predictions for this year's WWDC. And we had some luck with the education event. We were pretty good at predicting what was going to happen. Arguably, we had a lot more rumors. We haven't heard much about what software Apple might be releasing this year. So it's going to be a fun one. So I'm really looking forward to speculating with you on the next episode, Rambo.
Yeah, I'm really excited for it and I can't wait.
Me neither. Again, if you want to see this show happen more often, head over to our Patreon. It's patreon.com/stacktracepod. Just a few bucks a month makes a huge difference in making the show more sustainable and enabling us to spend more time working on this show. So if you are interested in that, please head over to our Patreon. But for now, that's it. You can find us on StackTracePod on Twitter. You can find me at John Sundell. You can find Guy at _inside. And you can also find us on our website, StackTracePodcast.fm, where you can also find all the show notes for this episode. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. And say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.